So I would note that our meeting tonight is being recorded now, and we go, we don't do minutes any longer since we do have recorded meetings, correct? So we're moving to community input. Does anybody have any community input tonight? Darla?
I just want to announce that the Clark County Disability Coalition Candidates Forum will be happening on October the 15th. And I apologize for not having flyers to give to you tonight. I thought they were ready, and they were not. So I will send them out to you through electronic version. And it's October the 15th. Networking starts at 6 o'clock. The forum starts at 6:30, and it's occurring at Clark College.
Which Geyser?
The local candidates that are going to be there, or state races, one federal.
Yeah. Are there going to be any representatives regarding pro and con the charter?
I don't know. I don't believe so. Okay. That was not something we targeted.
Okay.
So you are sending the information out.
I will send it out, yes. I apologize for not having it this evening.
I'll see that you get it and then you guys can send it out to the network.
Okay. Anything else? Anyone else have anything to add? Okay. Well, I have a flyer here for Heroes for Autism, and this is a training that's sponsored by the Autism Society of Washington. I think they're going to be training first responders and all community members interested in, looks like they're training on how to prepare and prevent crises, what you do before you make a 911 call, being involved without adding unnecessary drama or complication, tracking systems, databases. It looks like a good training. I think that they are bringing in, and I'm not sure that this flyer says it, but I'm also going from my memory of an email that I read, some national or speakers for it, correct? Darla, do you have more?
Just that they're bringing in a national speaker. And it's September 11th and 12th.
Right. And it looks like it's at the Camas Fire Department both days. And September 11th at 6 to 8 p.m. And the 12th it's 8 a.m. to noon. So.
Are they the same?
No, I don't think that they're the same. I think the September 11th training, the evening training, that's 2 hours, is what I just went through. Preventing the crises, 911 calls, getting involved without adding drama or complicating matters, tracking systems, but that the second day, it looks more about awareness of characteristic common behaviors of autism spectrum disorders, identifying the unknown individuals possibly being spectrum, strategies for engagement intervention, calming a highly anxious person to prevent escalation, techniques for handling aggression, and tracking systems. So it looks like the second day, the 4-hour training, which is twice as long as the first evening, is more about autism spectrum and identifying what individuals may be on the spectrum. We have some flyers here. If anyone would like a flyer,
you want to take them to the
family too? Okay.
Did you
want to? I'll pass one.
Okay.
If there's no more community input, then we move on to the special order section, and we have this clip here. Back to talk about accessible pedestrian signals.
This is actually his first time here. We read something from the governor's committee last time, and his name was in it. I called him, and he was so gracious to come and tell us about traffic code, pedestrian signals. Everything we wanted to know, right?
Maybe more than you wanted to know. My name is Rob Klug. I'm the traffic signal operations and engineering lead at Clark County. I'm going to be talking about what Clark County is doing, not necessarily what the City of Vancouver or the State Department of Transportation are doing at their traffic signals, because I work for Clark County. I work on the traffic signals in unincorporated Clark County off the state routes. So it can be very confusing as a consumer, as a citizen, to understand what's ours and what's theirs. And basically, if it's not in the city limits and it's not on State Route 500, 503, 502, it's probably one of ours. So we have about 105 traffic signals throughout Sifton, Orchards, Palmyra, Hazeldale, Salmon Creek, and some of the other areas in the more rural area. And we've been going through a pretty significant upgrade of all of our traffic signals corridor by corridor for about 4 years now. And one of the things that we've started implementing is upgrading the signals so that the pedestrian push buttons are meeting the recommended practices of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and also with the what's called the Manual Uniform Traffic Control Devices. It's a federal document that's state law. It doesn't say you have to use these, but it says if you do use them, they need to do certain things. My feeling is, number one, the feds are going to turn the tide at some point and say you have to put them in. It's coming, and we're going to have an unfunded mandate to put them in. These things are not cheap. This is one button for one corner. It has a sign that goes on top of it, and I'll pass this around. This is $400. The brain box that goes in the control cabinet is $2,000. So it generally runs around $5,000 an intersection just for the hardware. Then we have to be looking at a lot of other things that we're doing, such as location of these in relationship to where the curb ramp is, because they're not supposed to be on a point where a wheelchair would be on a downhill grade to push the button and wait. They're supposed to be the flat spot at the bottom. They're supposed to be separated by a certain distance. There's all these supposed to be's. And so when we went through on Highway 99 and we upgraded three intersections to make all the curb ramps meet the current ADA standards, and put the buttons in the proper locations at 99th Street, 78th Street, and 63rd Street and Highway 99, it was a $200,000 ticket by the time we added everything together to make three intersections fully compliant with the ADA. I don't want to make you think I'm complaining about that. That's not my point. My point is that it's very expensive to get this equipment in where it needs to be. We are retrofitting many decades of design thoughts where something was built back in the 60s or 70s or 80s that meant the best ideas at that time, and we have better ideas now, and we find that the things that we thought were just even 10 years ago no longer work. One of the things that we have to do is make sure that when you come off of the curb ramp into the road, that you have no more than a 2% cross slope for the roadway. So that means that when we redo a curb ramp, it's not just the curb ramp, it's also the asphalt for maybe up to 10 feet into the intersection to regrade that so that a wheelchair presumably doesn't get cocked and going in the wrong direction into the intersection, possibly into cars. There's all kinds of things that go into this that start adding cost to this. So we are programmatically putting these in our intersections as fast as we can. We currently have them in approximately a third of our intersections. Not all of them meet all the ADA requirements. We're doing as best we can with the infrastructure, because every time we go to move one of these to the proper location, it starts becoming, instead of $5,000 per intersection, it becomes $20,000 per intersection to put in extra poles, to put in extra conduit, to put in extra wire, and all the other things that go along with it. So our goal is to get them out, get them as right as we can, and then as capital projects come along, we'll make sure that they are truly right in the long term, and wherever we can, we're putting them into the proper location. So right now they are, like I said, at about 33%, about a third of our intersections. We are on track for over the next year putting them in another third of our intersections, and then we're looking as fast as we can to get the last group of them done. It's a big cost, and it's a big benefit. One of the main things is that they operate differently than what you're used to. The old buttons, they had a hemispherical button you pushed, and that button was oriented to cross the road, where you push the button in this way and you would cross the road that way. These buttons are exactly 90 degrees off of that. So where the old button would be here, push this way to cross, these buttons are 90 degrees off. So you push this way to cross, push. So the reason for that, you know, pass this around, this thing's heavy, you could use this as a club if you want to, is you feel that there's an arrow, it's a tactile arrow that's there, and the arrow actually guides the blind pedestrian in the direction that that crossing should be. So it's one of the many indications that tells the pedestrian what to do. The buttons that we're installing have a 2-pound pressure to push. And the idea is that a person who is in a wheelchair that uses a stylus in their mouth or in some other way to push the button, they only have to push with 2 pounds of pressure, and they can catch the stylus underneath the little hook and the arrow right there to help them be able to push the button. Other buttons that are out there are a little less expensive, and they take 6 to 7 pounds of pressure. We chose this one because it was a 2-pound pressure instead of a 6 or 7 pound pressure. Other buttons have the same sort of static feedback you have on your phone to say, I want to do something, and they have a static ability to push it, so there's no push on it at all. We chose not to do that because if a pedestrian uses a stylus and it is a plastic or a wood stylus, there's no static charge. So a person who needs to use a stylus to push the button, if they use one of the haptic response ones, would never get a call because it isn't pressure, it's actually static change. And so it's a great idea, but it doesn't work for 100% of the people. And maybe this doesn't work for 100% of the people too. We're doing the best we can with the technology that's out there. These buttons will do things slightly differently than you're used to. When you walk up and push them right now, they will say wait. And then when the flashing don't walk, when the steady don't walk comes on, try getting my act together here. When the steady walk comes on, there's a point to this. Alright. I'm going to play a sound for what you're gonna hear when you push one of these buttons. Okay, so I hope everyone can hear this. Wait, it's beeping. When the walk comes up, the rapid ticking sounds like an AK-47 going off. This is our federal government helping us. They decided that the cuckoo chirp sound was wrong, and so they've gone to this rapid tick sound that goes off during the walk, and it echoes from one side to the other to help the blind pedestrian wayfind across the road. And then that beeping sound, the locator sound that you hear, is playing at one tone, one volume level, and there's microphones on that device that actually listen to the background sound, and they ramp up and down the sound, so it stays about 3 to 4 decibels above the ambient sound. So that's good and that's bad, because sometimes they get stuck and they don't work right, and the neighbors get really upset. Because they have their windows open at 10 o'clock at night, and all they hear is this. They hear that beep, 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 beep. And there's, for some reason, people don't like that.
Really, somebody shooting the machine that's stuck on me.
So when the button is in walk, it makes the rapid fire tick sound. And then when it goes to flash and don't walk, the locator tone gets louder to help the pedestrian locate across the street. And when it goes to steady don't walk at the end, then it'll go back to its normal volume level. Now that button, actually, these are kind of unique in those buttons, that those buttons actually have a vibro-tactile pad in them. And so if the blind person or the deaf person holds their hand on the button, when it goes to walk, that button will actually vibrate for them to let them know that there's something that's going on. So it helps them guide by the arrows pointing in the direction they should be going. And if they're sending out in the middle of the intersection, they're oriented wrong. They should be pointing you directly across the crosswalk. And that button helps them orient the direction and helps them know that when it vibrates, and they if they can hear the sound or they can feel the vibration, that can help them cross the road. So right now, all the buttons we're putting in have the standard MUTCD message, which is the rapid fire tick sound. One of the things that we're going to be rolling into over the next year is we're going to be finding a standard message that says, wait to cross Highway 99, or wait to cross 78th Street. And then when the walk comes on, instead of the rapid fire tick, it will say, walk sign is on to cross 78th Street, or walk sign is on to cross Highway 99. So we're right now we're just trying to put as many of them in as we can, and we just haven't got our act together enough to put the message in, anything other than the standard messages, but that's coming. So our goal is, with all the improvements we're doing in the county, is to have those on 100% of our traffic signals. And the city, I don't know what their method is to get them out. I don't know what the states are. It is not mandatory to do, but it's something that is the right thing to do for the county, so that's why we're doing it.
How do you decide what intersection gets this kind of speed?
Well, the primary way we've been putting them in has been we are doing an upgrade of the signals on a corridor. Like, we just finished up a project on Highway 99 and 78th Street. So Highway 99 from 63rd all the way up to 117th, and 78th Street from St. John's all the way to Northwest 9th Avenue. There were 30-odd intersections and all that that we did. We just added it to every intersection, period. And so it's easy for us to do big, long corridors as part of our capital projects that we do the signal upgrade projects. Other locations, we would put them in as fast as we can put them in, given the fact that it's $5,000 per intersection for the hardware. If we're taking it out of our maintenance budget, as requests come in, we would retrofit them in as fast as we can roll it into our maintenance budget. It's important that the pedestrians have the ability to cross the road in a safe manner as possible. And this is part of the tools in the toolbox that we have. So we intend to do it as fast as we can, and if there's a specific location that needs to be done out of the normal step, we'll find a way to do it. We just need to know that there's a request.
I was going to ask, so I hear you're talking for the county's perspective, but isn't there some kind of coordinated effort between the city and the state where they come together that blind people aren't trying to figure out, or deaf or whatever, each one of the different buttons and what they do and trips and...
I'm going to be very careful what I say here.
Okay, I got you.
I understand. The county and the city and the state do meet on a regular basis for a lot of different issues regarding traffic signals. The reality, I think it's perfectly fair to say, is that our budget reality is different than the city's budget reality, and that's different than the state's budget reality. When I've talked to my equivalent at the city, they're very interested in doing this. It's just that they haven't been able to find the revenue stream to be able to do it. And so we're talking about consistency of message, consistency of installation, but they're wrestling with the fact that they've got more than twice as many signals as we do, and the budget is just not the same. So I don't think that there's any lack of desire. It's just a matter of how do they get their ducks in a row to do a similar sort of thing.
Well said.
You know, one of my concerns is that some kind of signalization, like what you're talking about, close in proximity to public transportation, would be important, because you know you're going to generate people that are going to be walking to and from that bus stop. Is that something that you factor in determining whether or not a particular intersection is going to get upgraded?
It hasn't been. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be. Like I said, the primary focus has been with our large project. We're doing corridors at a time. We're putting in all the signals on those projects. So when we opened up the new 139th Street overpass last Wednesday, we retrofitted these into about a half dozen signals around that were county signals to basically just force it into the project so that we can do it. You're very right. There's probably other locations we could be looking at, and C-Tran wants to give us a list of where they're interested. We can work on trying to find a way.
Good. We'll do that.
C-Tran.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I just got a comment. I think it's amazing. So can we tell the story? It seems like we ought to have a PR campaign saying, woo, way to go. This is awesome, good for you. And here's how they work for consumers, so they come up and they're not ignorant about how to access all those wonderful features.
I actually was working with CB. The reason why I'm wearing a tie today, I'm not used to having a tie. I was working with CBTV. I was working with CBTV where we're starting to put together like a minute segment on how to cross using these and put them on the county's website, put them on rotation on CBTV, et cetera. I'm going to be honest with you. I shun the limelight. I have no desire to be in the limelight. My desire is to just do my job and then do the next project and do the next project. And we do a lot of things really well at the county. And I think that there's a lot of people like me that just want to just start the next project rather than celebrate the one we just finished.
I think the impetus for the city or for others to find resources to continue the project outside your areas, if you hold up this limelight or the spotlight on this great thing you're doing.
I just want to make sure that everyone's aware that we work very closely with the city, and we do not want to create a situation where the county is making the city look bad, saying the city doesn't want to create a situation where the county's looking bad. You know, we're all on this together. We're all trying to find a solution. And like I said before, we have different budget realities. And I can't explain why the city spends money the way they do. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. It's their decision as to how they use their money, and I'm in no position to offer any opinion on it.
Well, sometimes they can't explain how they spend money either, but it's nice to know that there is cooperative conversation, because even if they don't have it today, they're going to have projects that come up. And so planning for them at that time, so it does at least happen over time, would be...
And what I'm hearing from the state is that on all new signals, on their major upgrades, they're putting them in. We're doing a project right now where we're hopefully beginning of next year, we're going out to bid to upgrade 30 traffic signals in the Sifton and Orchards area. And that includes all the traffic signals for the DOT on Patton and 162nd Avenue. And they've asked that we put this exact same device in all their traffic signals, because it's part of the upgrade, and we're working with them where they're paying their share of the grant match, and we're designing it as part of our project. So we have a large project that hopefully we get really good contractor bids on. Because if you do a project that has two traffic signals, you're not going to get the same type of bid as when you have 35. Right. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do, is lump and get the best prices. Yes?
My concern was somewhat along the lines of Mona's, and that was, as you were saying this, I was recalling the email that brought it to our attention. It was months ago, so forgive me, I may not be correct, but it seemed as if someone encountered one of the signals and just wasn't sure how to use it, and it wasn't making the same sound, and they didn't know to leave their hand on it to feel the vibration to cross. And so if it's going on CBTV and it's going on the county's website, a short video about the changes in use, it concerns me that perhaps the groups you're trying to reach may not be tuning into CBTV from the county's website. So is there any other way that we can get this distributed to groups that, or businesses or nonprofits that come into contact with people with the disabilities that would be impacted by the changes, that they know?
And part of it, I'll admit, is ignorance on my part. The assumption that I made was that because the Americans with Disabilities ADAG group basically designed this as a standard over a decade ago, and because the Federal Highway Administration made it the standard for if you're going to do it, this is how you're going to do it in 2003, the assumption I made was because this was the standard that was going to be put out there, and it had been basically not black letter law, but the black letter law was if you're going to do it, this is what the buttons must do. It's been that way for over a decade. The assumption I made was the community must know about it because it's been, and that was a wrong assumption on my part. So I've met with the blind community now once, and this is my second meeting, and we're trying to struggle with how do we get the message out to the proper people, and I'm looking for help with that. And so I'm
we can help you with that.
Okay. Yeah. And you know, it doesn't have to be glitzy. It's just that we want to make sure people understand that this is different from what they've seen before.
Kids, is there any electronic verbiage of all of this that we could just, in a package, send out?
Not that I've seen. There's there's black letter law that is very dry and very difficult to read. But part of it is I'm working with our public information and outreach people to say, how do we package this information? And the first step is getting a video out on the CBTV, and then the question is, where do we need to go from there? And it's a very challenging question because the county's doing one thing, and the city and the state are doing it to some extent. They're not doing it wholesale like we are, and I don't know how to approach the idea of us going at different speeds approaching into this.
Well, all you have to talk about is what is happening in the county.
Right.
You don't have to explain the city or the state. And if you're working with the PIO office, is that correct?
Yes.
If they would write something up and get it to me, I can see that Darla sends it out to probably 1,000 people.
Okay.
And those networks.
Okay. And I'll work with them to see how we can get something that is relatively, I don't want to make it a super technical document. It's got to be something that's very succinct.
Yeah, simple.
And simple.
Fantastic.
Maybe some photos.
Pictures. Yeah. When it sounds like a machine gun, run.
I want to be careful about that because the current message is the machine gun. Our goal is to get them in saying, wait to cross Highway 99.
But that could be in your materials, too.
Currently it does, but look for it to be.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And schools, I mean, because some of the schools are in the county and some are in various cities. So.
Transition programs.
Right. Yeah, we need to get it. We can easily get stuff to special ed. That's not a problem. Susan can take it to camp.
Well, a lot of the populations that will actually need to know.
Yeah, and actually, I was having a couple different thoughts related to this. One is the whole, the sound, and I was in Walla Walla, really, for the first time in my life this summer, and I grew up here in Washington. I've lived here my whole life. But theirs is that, it says wait, and then it says walk to cross whatever street it was. And then, rather than a toner, it says 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. And so by the time I was long gone, I heard 1. But that was kind of helpful, I thought.
And when wrestling with a specific message, one of the challenges that we do have is what is the best message to give people? And when I sat down with the blind group about a month ago, they had 10 people in the room and there were 15 opinions about the Every opinion was very strongly held, where some people thought that was the best answer and other people said, no, I don't need any of that. Just tell me where I'm crossing. Other people said, no, I don't even need that. I like this.
And so the second thing related to, Mary indicated that I work in the Camas School District, is we have seniors in high school that are required to do senior projects. Mm-hmm. And this is the time of year that they're fishing for projects and they're looking for a cause. And so if we could get information, maybe Darla could work with somebody, a mentor, even just to make a very simple pamphlet that has some pictures, has some information that can be then distributed throughout the county.
And I don't know that Canvas is necessarily the best, because we don't design Canvas signals.
But if it's in the county, passionate students.
But all the signals in the Canvas School District are within the city of Canvas School. And the city of Canvas owns them, and we time them and we maintain them for them. But we don't tell them what they're going to do. So when we put in our signals and we upgrade our signals, they're in unincorporated Clark County as opposed to not the city of Vancouver.
And it doesn't need to be. I'm really sad. I found out yesterday my husband works in the Vancouver School District. They've dropped the senior project. There's no.
Really?
Yeah. So that's why I say Canvas, because I work there and we rock. But we do have students that live in Canvas that have a Vancouver address, and so they're not technically, you know, but I can send a feeler out to a couple of people at the high school to see, and to say if you have somebody that would be interested in taking on a project like this, just do some PR.
As long as everyone understands, the vast majority of our traffic signals are going to be in the Evergreen School District and in the Vancouver School District.
Yes, but a lot of our, like 192nd, that's Evergreen.
That's City Vancouver.
Yeah.
That's not us.
But they can make it so that it's just generic.
Right.
And that way it only gets, you can be utilized on however you guys would want to utilize it and send it out to wherever you want to send it out to. It'll just be generic.
Well, I can tell you this much, if it's a if it's a PIO piece that's put out by the county, our PIO department is going to have their fingerprints all over it.
Yeah,
they're going to control the message because they have their, they have very specific ideas as to how things need to be presented to the public. And I just said that and realized that could be taken a lot of negative ways, and that was not intended to be a negative
comment. A student could work with the
PIO.
We had a student with autism work with the PIO department before, and they were great with them. So,
that's just part of the seniors' education that they go through and working with different entities. And
it's too bad they couldn't create like a YouTube link or something to show someone using it.
Customers passed around and show the benefits to somebody that's caring for it.
And that's part of what we're trying to pick up with the video. I went out there and talked about the buttons. I contacted one of the people in the blind community that was very interested in having some of the blind community out there actually showing the use of the buttons in the Hazeldale area. So we're trying to work towards that. And my to be honest, I'm an engineer. I'm not a public information outreach person. So what I think is right may be very different than what
probably, yeah.
So let me ask you an engineering question. Okay. How do you determine the length of time that you're allowed to walk on a controlled intersection?
Okay, I will tell you. I will tell you how I do it for Clark County.
Okay.
And I will tell you that the City of Vancouver and the State Department of Transportation appear to do it differently.
Okay.
There is a lot of I'm not trying to be negative. The law is very open as to how it says you're supposed to time the walk and the flash and don't walk. There are some suggestions in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices that talk about how you should time the walk and the flash and don't walk. Generally, unless we have a lot of pedestrians crossing in a location, a lot of them at any one time, we time our walks to be 5 seconds. So we want the person to get started and then cross the intersection during the flash and don't walk. The flash and don't walk is actually this really convoluted, it's a very convoluted equation that says if I step off the curb here, I have to be able to have enough flash and don't walk that when I step off the curb here, that when I step back on the curb here, walking at 3.5 feet per second, I can cross that time in the time to cross that distance at 3.5 feet per second. Then I do a second calculation on top of that that says, if I'm standing at the pedestrian push button and I take into account the walk, the flash and don't walk, the yellow and the all red time, and I stand at the push button and the walk comes up, the combination of walk, flash and don't walk, yellow and all red has to be able to allow me to walk from this point here to stepping off the curb here at 3 feet per second. So there's a double calculation that takes into account how long this button is from the curb, how long the walk crossing is, and all kinds of other things like that. So when you look at how the county times are flashing don't walks, they're going to be longer than you're going to see in the city or the state because we're adding a couple of things in that apparently they're doing differently.
That was an engineering question.
I was going to say, get somebody in a walker that's like 112 years old, you just time how quick it takes to get across, and use that as a standard.
Well, the challenge is there's a few things that go into corridor timing. When you look at a big, long corridor of traffic signals, one of the things that goes into the corridor timing is the biggest intersection, all the intersections have to have the same cycle length. So the biggest intersection is going to govern the cycle length for the entire corridor. So if you have an intersection like 20th and 134th that you're crossing 12 lanes of traffic as a pedestrian, you have 35 seconds of flash and don't walk going one direction and 32 seconds of flash and don't walk going the other direction. And the vast majority of pedestrians cross well inside that time. But when we start adding in all the time we need to make 20th and 134th work without busting the coordination pattern, all of a sudden it makes it so that all the signals on 134th, all the signals on Highway 99 need to run at 150-second cycle length. Because that massive intersection dominates everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to balance, everybody's trying to balance the pros and cons of how do we get the pedestrians across the intersection in a safe manner and not have three intersections down the road that has a minor street have to have a 2.5 minute wait for the green.
Yeah, I understood.
And it's all about balance.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, the story on the national news a couple weeks ago was it's all about gridlock, too. And that really pushing that button does nothing. It's all timed anyway, so it doesn't matter. But when you push a button, it's all designed around keeping the traffic moving. And that was, you know, they said smaller towns it can be different, but a lot of your large metro areas is all done to keep traffic from getting backed up.
And there is some truth to that.
Yeah.
But still, we find ways to put the walk and flash and don't walk time in. But the fact of the matter is, when I time signal for coordination, I'm timing it so the cars can get through, not a pedestrian walking at whatever speed they are from block to block to block.
Yeah.
What's the appropriate answer? We have 30,000 cars a day on the road, and we have 200 pedestrians. What's the appropriate thing we should do?
Yeah,
the cars.
On 88th Street, when you guys widened that just recently, in about 30 seconds or something, because I go walking, there's a signal, and it's just across the street. But do you have some that sense when someone's coming by? Because I don't touch it, but it seems to beep or something when I go by.
That's a rapid rectangular flashing beacon.
Okay. It's not a
rapid.
I'm glad I
asked. And that's actually something where the box, instead of being a traffic signal as green, yellow, red, it has a box that's about that big that sits about 8 feet in the air.
Oh,
okay. And there's two LEDs in there. They alternate where one flashes 3, then 2, and the other one flashes like 1, then 4. And so they alternate in their flash. And they're really, really obtrusive, and you can't help but notice them from a quarter mile away. But those particular devices for a crosswalk like that have been found to have almost a 95% compliance rate with the drivers. So we're trying that out with the intent of rolling them out at more school crossings, where we've got a marked crosswalk that normally during school hours would be a flagging, a couple of kids or a couple of parents flagging the arterial when the school crossing, when the kids are crossing. The issue is what happens during the other 23 hours out of the day, and you've got this crosswalk that looks like a great place to cross, but maybe the driver does or doesn't see the pedestrian as the pedestrian steps off the road. So that's to draw a lot of attention there, right where it is. Those crossings there, they include a version of this that beeps.
Okay.
And so when you walk up and push it, it will start the flashing to cross, and it will tell you to, I forget what the message is, there's a message in there also that tells you, you know, cross traffic may not stop or something like that. But that was the first one we put in as an experiment, and we're looking to actually grow that to provide other crossings around the area.
Well, because I walk by it and I don't touch it, but it seems to do something.
Well, does it turn on or does it?
I don't. I'm just walking by it.
Okay.
But it sounds. I mean, to me, there's a sound so that somebody knows it's there.
That's the locator tone.
Okay.
That's actually. It sounds like a ping,
yeah,
pop, pop, pop,
like
pop.
That. Yeah.
Well, that's going so that a blind person has the ability to find that button.
Yeah. Okay.
And so they can use that to locate the button without seeing it.
Yeah.
And it's actually that's the tone that listens to the background noise, and it gets more loud and less loud based upon what the background noise is. It'll typically reside 3 to 4 decibels above the background noise. So if you sit there and listen to it, it'll actually go up and down in volume as cars go by. As to help the people that need additional help to find this button to find it without having to see it.
I kind of wondered what that was because I mean I'm not. I'm just walking by it, but
it,
you know, I thought I heard something, you know.
We're trying to keep the volume as low as possible so it doesn't offend the neighbors. But we still have to find a way.
Yeah, but it's
lovely,
really not very, you know.
Yes.
Very nice. Thank you. I do want to say, I'm here, so well, I got a question for you because I live in Maple Gate, and the one that the Cross Dakota Geyser really concerns me because it doesn't respond a lot when the kids are pushing it to go in the morning. And my concern is that someday some kid, because I will watch the traffic and go across because it's a really long light going north, east and west, and it doesn't necessarily respond to those kids, and I'm real concerned about that.
That signal is actually doing something very special.
Driving us all crazy.
No, it's
teaching the kids.
The corridor on 99th Street is running from 3 p.m. on, uh-huh. and from 3 p.m. until about 8 p.m., it's running at 150-second cycle, like 2.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that's to make it so that we have a green band that allows you to progress through as many traffic signals as possible as you're going east and west through the corridor and dealing with the interchange and all the congestion that occurs at 7th Avenue and Hazeldale, et cetera. So that signal between 3 p.m. and 8 p.m. actually does something where it does a double cycle within the parent cycle of 150 seconds. So if you come up on the side street, depending as to when you hit it in relationship to the greens, you'll have a much shorter wait than you would normally at a traffic signal running on a long cycle length. The downside is the way that the controller works, I can't double cycle the pedestrians, I can only double cycle the cars. So when you place a call, it will place the call, and then in the next two cycles, it will come up with a walk for the pedestrians crossing. But I can't make it do it every single time. So if the pedestrians do the same thing the cars are supposed to do, and that is only cross when the light says you're supposed to, there's no problem there. But if pedestrians get impatient, they're not waiting any longer than they would have waited if we were running it on a long 150-second cycle length where it was only getting one bite at the apple every 2.5 minutes. And the whole point is we've got 12,000 cars a day at that location on 99th Street. Trust me, the reason why I know all these things is because I get a lot of phone calls about this one. Yeah. It only does it from 3 p.m. until about 8 p.m.
Because I'm talking about like 8:30 in the morning.
It runs free all day long, all morning long. And then it's a matter of whether or not the pedestrian's getting impatient and they're crossing.
Well, thank you
thank
for
you.
Coming.
Yeah. Thank you.
And thank you for the primer on pedestrian signals because I didn't know. I never knew.
Yeah, I never knew that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So we'll get, I'll get in touch with Mary Kelson. See if she can get something written up.
A better person would be Jeff Mies with Public Works. He's our PIO with
Public Works. Oh, you have your PIO.
Yeah.
PIO.
Yeah. Jeff Mies. M-I-Z-E.
All right.
And then he works with Mary Kelts and the other PIO.
I know Jeff.
Okay.
So it might be good to hear from one of your colleagues from the city of Vancouver. Or that would be helpful to understand their perspective and maybe educate us.
Do you want me to ask?
Someone from the
November?
Okay.
All right,
we'll
do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well,
there's no more questions,
though. Okay,
thank you. Thank you for knowing all of that. Families. So next we have bylaws, PDAB bylaws. Scott.
Okay. Thanks to Mary. She brought a copy of the bylaws for your perusal. When I first received the email about this, I thought, hopefully, what have I been asked to do? Bylaws, that's serious business. Is the old one or the new one?
This is the new one.
Oh, I've got a copy. Isn't that what it's like right out?
So, you need one?
Thanks.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind. So, I started reading through it. It sounds pretty good to me. Hey, what the problem was? So, what I discovered pretty quickly is I was reading the new ones. So, Mary did send me out a redlined copy so that I could actually understand what was going on. And then when I read through it down, it came down even simpler for my thick head. And that is, it really was just the verbiage being updated to be current. And one example, I didn't think you'll need to do the whole thing, correct?
It's up to you.
Well, if you would like to, tell me after the meeting. But what really stood out right on the first page, it was section 3, B. And so the original, if you're looking at the new, the original says, assist the Social Services Planning Commission in the development and maintenance of a comprehensive social service plan. So I think you can quickly see and read the new one that this is cleaned up and more current with the verbiage and in the line for the way that it's actually what is performed. And so the action, I believe, we are required to seek a motion to approve these from our board.
I move that we approve the changes in the bylaws.
I'll second that. Any discussion?
I just wondered if there are any other significant things. I mean, that one was pretty clear. Is there anything else you think might be of interest?
Yeah, that's a great question. I did honestly read the whole thing, trying to find out if there was something that jumped out, because I was really expecting my job to be much, much, much harder. But it really was verbiage. Yeah, it really was just verbiage cleanup. And I did read the entire thing, and I didn't find one thing of question. Matter of fact, I consistently found everything that I read to make it so it's much easier for me to understand, because we're using current terminology and so forth.
I
didn't find anything that I would share.
People first language was the biggest thing, because we were still using the word mental retardation, and that is no longer used in our state. The federal government has walked away from that, and we weren't putting the people first in that one. So I was telling Larry that I know we redid these in 2002, because I have the copy. We still didn't get it right in 2002, but we didn't adopt them either.
So, reading the record that I finally got the job done, and they failed to do it.
Well, we haven't adopted it officially yet.
Oh, there you go. I didn't even use the very first one to read out, because it was offensive. It was very offensive. Yes. Mm-hmm. And especially with my daughter, I was surprised they weren't changed earlier on some of it. So.
Well, they might have been.
So hopefully we will today.
Well, if there's no further discussion, we have a motion to approve. A second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so these are adopted. Motion passes. Great. Thank you so much.
Tempered more brain cells than I needed to by far.
Actually, this was one, the bylaws. We have another prosecutor type in the prosecutor's office, Christine Cook. And Christine got very involved in the bylaws, so we all did less than we would have typically in the past, because she embraced them.
Okay. So. Yeah, it was well done.
The next item on the agenda is the Washington Self-Advocates Proclamation, and there were copies in the back of the proclamation itself and some information about how it came to be, about the self-advocates that put this together and got this into the congressional record. It's just two pages, front and back. I think it is awesome. I think it's very comprehensive and to the point, and that it contains a lot of the concerns that people in our community have voiced. And the idea is there anything, it is so great, is there any ideas about should we do something locally with this proclamation?
Is the event in October maybe a place to either display or to have that available for folks? Part of maybe items that they may pick up during the event?
Okay.
There's sometimes collateral material that's available at those events that might be helpful.
Let's talk on Monday when you all meet, the next committee meets. Let's talk about it. And in the meantime, if board members have this, I don't know if this went out to you earlier, I cannot remember. But if you have ideas, would you get them to me, and will and anybody in the audience, if you have ideas about things we can do to promote this. I thought it was very nicely written, and one of our congressional members up north introduced it into the congressional record.
I think that this document that's with it is almost as valuable. Because talking about the process, it really did go out. You know, some of these proclamations that we hear, I mean, you're not quite sure who wrote it, why, you know, and this really talks about how it came about, how it put some character to it, some personality, some people were actually thought it was important and pushed it forward. I like this piece almost as much as I like the proclamation itself.
We have a little iPad, one of those fancy iPads there that people can log on at the event when they're noticing this and sign up to support them. This was a website?
No.
Allies Advocacy. That'd be great. Really, Susan, advocacy. But I wanted to give you an iPad or somewhere people could link up and either comment or sign in support of the website. But I think they should go out to the, we should send it out to the special ed, especially the Clark Transition Program. I think it would be a great special studies piece for their transition students and having that voice and being a part of something that has, can have that kind of effect.
If this document here is going to be put out there, might want to fix the typo.
The official?
The off-field.
That's a new way of saying
the federal off-field.
Sometimes you can just do pull quotes from the proclamation and interwoven with the program. Sometimes it makes some of the more striking statements as a way to kind of create additional interest. It's just a marketing tool, marketing gimmick. But
yeah, I think we'll want to look at that before. I'm on the website right now.
Yeah.
It doesn't look so easy to just have people line up to use it. And so, although that sounds easy, it's not like quite like Facebook where you just go in and like it. It's not fancy on their website.
Okay.
So, we want to look at it before we make the decision
how
to choose this.
So, you think
it's
hard?
I think it's great, but I think it's going to be too hard for people to have to figure out. Maybe if we have somebody stand there, and that might be. But just looking at it, you can pull down the proclamation, you can pull down the history, it says signatures, which I'm assuming is where you kind of endorse it or something.
We can have a signature page, that's a paper one, and I can send it in.
I think that'd be a good idea because this one I don't think will be so easy to. And sorry, I shifted energy into our discussion of our program.
But it seems to morph into that. So, what's the action that you need for this particular?
Well, I didn't know. I just thought maybe you might have supported it, or I don't know what you want to do. It maybe isn't that action. I mean, maybe it's what we do with it.
Is there a value to have our endorsement?
Probably.
Okay. Then I think that that's something that we should do as a way to voice, to bring a voice of Southwest Washington, Clark County specifically, you know, as far as to this particular proclamation.
So, and one more comment is they have a Facebook page where we can have people go through, or if they're used to using Facebook, go through and hit. They've only got 72 on there. Yeah, we can double that.
Yeah.
Yeah, one fell through.
Okay.
Well, it does say on the back side of this information here, it says that the goal of the group is in part to support and offer suggestions to make it better. So if anyone has any suggestions, we can offer in behalf of the DBAB or whatever.
So I guess my motion is to give our endorsement of the self-advocates proclamation to show our unity with other advocates.
I second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
I also keep track of the motions that have passed each year, so it'll be on some kind of record.
Okay. On to the October event update. I don't know why I put you on there, Susan.
I'm glad I eventually showed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
October event is around the corner.
It's in October, isn't it?
It is in October, which, so for you to know it, it will be here. We have had some nominations submitted in the four categories, employee, employer, and the Dennis Campbell Award. And so we are meeting as a devoted group next Monday at 4 p.m., which means I won't be visiting the hospital to find out. But that's okay. This is more important. To review the nominations and make some informed decisions based on the for the submissions. And so thank you for anyone and everyone who submitted a nomination for any of or all of the categories. Please invite friends and family and educators. And do we have an event flyer that could be electronically sent out to?
It's all coming Monday with Jim.
Oh, okay. So if he sends it to me, then I can send it to my
he
in the district.
Chris had some, but he's also probably will
have the electronic.
Yeah,
the electronic version that we could share on Facebook.
Yeah. That's really amazing. It's going to be amazing event. And remember, it is at the Heathman Hotel this year. So you probably, it's the other H Hotel. So don't go to the Hilton, because that would be really disappointing. They probably have, I don't know, a fly fishing in their glass or something going on. But yes, the Heathman Lodge near Vancouver Mall. I know it's not called that anymore, but that's what I call it. Westfield Shopping Center, just to the west of Westfield Shopping Center. And it should be a sparkling event. Jim Corey from Wise organized it, and he did a fabulous job last year. New Seasons is still a kind of helping sponsor, along with Vancouver Chamber of Commerce and.
Yes, but now on the proclamation. So Walt is going to come to the city of Battleground, which is actually going to be early September 15th.
September 15th at 7 o'clock.
Right.
If anybody wants to join
anybody
me at
else
city.
Wants to go to Battleground. Then on October 6th, there are two opportunities. There's the city of Camas at 7 p.m. and the city of Vancouver at 7 p.m. So, I'll go to Camas, Trish will go to Vancouver, and who all wants to join?
Well, Ted's going to join because he's not here, obviously.
If anybody wants to come and receive the proclamation,
Monday,
October 6th.
There's six. They're both in the same evening, but there's enough people. There's only one or two.
come and receive it?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't understand that process.
Oh, well, when we go to, and they do a proclamation at the city, for example, they will give it to us, and it's an opportunity to say something on public record.
And you get a microphone, the camera's on you only. It's your
all right.
You go for it.
They want you to make it short, like a minute or two.
Found.
Right, you don't want to be.
I don't know if I can.
That leaves roll down, so.
But not everybody has to say something, but it's always nice if, you know, somebody joins.
So Mary, you're going to be there?
I'll be at Camas.
I might be able to do that.
Monday. 7
p.m.
And so we have.
I'll come to Vancouver. Mary Lee is Vancouver.
I have to see what I can do. Yeah. I don't have my.
Do we have anything for Richfield yet?
We have not heard from Richfield yet, mm-hmm. So I have to contact Richfield in the center. Are you going to be talking to
him?
I know him less well.
Jim Irish, I'll see both him and maybe, either Jim Irish will be there representing La Center and Richfield, or Roman Onslow will be there representing Richfield and La Center. Usually they both don't come at the same time, so do you have any indication whether or not Steve was able to?
Steve said he would do that, and then Pete was talking to him about hiring somebody, so I don't know if he got distracted, but I can call Steve Stewart.
Can you? Because I'd be happy to go just down the street to Richfield and get that work.
Absolutely.
What time is it again?
7 p.m. The cities are always at 7 p.m. and anybody is welcome to attend their speech. Darla, you're a resident of north of Belgrade now, so you're welcome to come on the 15th.
Trip the 15th. I transferred to the 18th district now, so.
So anyway, you can see the city council of Battleground if you so desire.
But don't ask them about their little traffic signals.
I don't have it. Trish, I might try to make the Vancouver one with you too.
Great.
I usually bring the dog and then they ask more questions about the dog than anything. I went back like a week later and did a CCI presentation for him.
Oh, great.
But Ted's always so great to have there because one of the things that Ted has done since if you're going to go really, my second day of school and I've already got all my language skills back.
Sure.
If you're going to be there, one of the things that Ted has made a connection to the importance of this event and having a child in the community and how employment is so important to them and all that stuff. So it's always nice for them to hear stuff like that and those success stories. And you've got a great one. Ted went with you last year to the city of Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
You're
volunteering kind of for the city of Cam.
Other
fun. He lives
in the city of Vancouver.
All right. That works.
All right. Mm-hmm. Legislative agenda.
Okay. This is the time when we think about the legislative agenda. We're not going to make a decision on it tonight because I think y'all need some time to think about it and someplace. I have last year's agenda, which is plenty of copies.
I don't think it's changed much in the past few years, the priorities.
This year is a budget year, isn't it?
This year is a budget year, and it's a really dicey budget. And Darlene, you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, that's right.
So we've already been asked to give budget cuts, and so they're trying to do priorities and different things like that, trying to get prepared for this upcoming legislative year. And so, because there's been some lawsuits around mental health, and there's lawsuits around school districts, and I'm going to work really hard to see this. And I don't necessarily see this year that we're going to get a lot of gains. If we cannot get cut this year, it's going to be a success, in my mind.
And where are we at biggest risk for cuts?
I can't tell you off the top of my head. I know that there's so many moving parts right now, it's kind of hard to tell. I'm very concerned to want to make sure we have funding for transition students next year, right? I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
There's also, you know, stuff that they approved last session that hasn't been fully implemented yet as far as new services. And if we push that back, so for example, what I'm going to talk about in a minute is CSCO. If we push that back a year, which there is talk of, that's going to push back how many new families get services as well. So, as usual, employment is a huge concern for me. We've got way too many families waiting for individual and family services.
Well, that would be taken care of with the CFCO, correct?
If we don't push it back, yes, it will.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of moving parts this year.
The last time there was a really tight budget year, seems like we gained a little bit of traction on some RHC movement. Is there any chance of getting further ground in that area?
Well, it depends on who you listen to. There is some discussion of actually using some of the RHC beds for mental health beds and mental health placements. Good, bad, or indifferent, that I think would then, if they do that, move some individuals out, but not everyone seems to agree that that's the course they're moving forward in.
Yeah, so. Medicaid has come out with a statement on settings, however, and whenever the state is going to renew its waiver, which I think Washington is due in 2016, if they don't tinker with it before that, if they open up the waiver at all, the clock ticks on setting, and that means that, I'll cast this out, Stewart in Snohomish County wrote this, and it's buried in here, that on I don't remember where it's buried, but the whole setting thing is you have to be in the most inclusive setting possible. So nursing homes, no institutions, no sheltered work, no. Settings need to be typical and inclusive. And that just came out in January of this year as their final rule. But it doesn't start the clock until the waiver is due, and then it gives them like 120 days to start doing something. And I wouldn't go into a close the institution mode because that would start a war we don't need right now, but we could support the direction of, and I can figure out some words for it, the direction of the federal government in terms of setting, being inclusive and people having the right to the most, you know, to employment, to living freely, that kind of stuff.
We could use some of the language from the proclamation.
The proclamation, yeah. Mm-hmm. We could piggyback on that.
They're also looking at doing a waiver for individual and family services, and so and then the CFCO, which is not a waiver but a optional service. But we're looking at pretty significant cuts, so like 15% cuts, and that's state only. So if it's a match service, we're looking at 30%. So we need to do a lot of advocacy this year.
The one thing about people with developmental disabilities is that it's an underfunded system, and if you start cutting too much, you're going to be spending money someplace else.
Mm-hmm. Pay me now or pay me later.
Pay me. Yeah. It's not one where you're going it's not a win to cut. So anytime we can get people to understand that you push down on DD and your crisis will go up or your families will be worn out. So you push down on employment and people will have nothing to do. Then what are you going to do?
Then your mental health goes up.
Then your mental health goes up, So hopefully we can... you have to figure out how you want to deal with it if you want the January stuff again. And I think we come back in November and take a look. Mm-hmm. And I've got some things to think about. Okay. Do you want to do it in January again like we've been doing?
Mm-hmm. That's kind of our window, isn't it?
It's been working better than getting them all together. It's because they don't want to... They
want to
be together anymore.
They want to live independent, meaningful lives. They don't want to be grouped according to legislative identity.
They need a proclamation.
On to Darla with the community first choice option update.
In between, we'll also, if you get a legislative agenda, we can send that out to the board so that they have the more sense of
okay, we'll work on that. So I've been on a group that's been meeting. We're putting forth recommendations to the legislature for a community first choice option. This is a state option, and what it would do is it would allow us to take our Medicaid personal care dollars that are currently done through the waiver and through those for the individuals that are also not on the waiver, to pull them out and put them in a separate group where they would all receive their Medicaid personal care under a community first choice option. With that, we would get a higher match from the federal government, and that would, it's actually a 6% increase in the match. Now, 3% of that increase is already dictated by going this route. There's certain things you have to do. For example, there is a teaching component that has to be implemented. You no longer can just do 4 as you do it currently in Medicaid personal care, but you actually do a teaching to help teach someone how to provide their own personal care issues, which is just a win-win situation. And there's some other components along with that in the community first choice option. The group that I've been meeting with of stakeholders is we're looking at what recommendations are we going to put forth to the legislature and how we are recommending the other 3% be spent. And so we actually have a meeting that's coming up Friday in which we're going to spend the majority of the meeting reviewing, prioritize the recommendations that we've been working on, because we have to get back to the Joint Legislative Executive Committee by September 15th on what our recommendations are for that other 3% of funding. 3% doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a huge chunk of funding. So some of the things that we've identified is expand family caregiver supports, including respite, restore in-home client hours, buy down caseload ratios to do a better job on person-centered planning, skill and independence building, behavioral supports, maintain training to get more tribal community health representatives, create choice and options for community integration and activities, navigators to connect clients with the community, healthy living initiatives, one-time purchase of assistive technology to foster independence, access current training to ensure it's meeting current needs, one-time environmental modifications, and creation of an online person-centered planning tool that would help families identify needs, services, and mm-hmm. aid in care planning.
Online person-centered?
Yes.
That's an oxymoron.
It kind of is. Anyway. Clearly, there's not enough funding to do all of these things. So our meeting on Friday will be trying, we have to each go forth and try to sell our ideas as to what we think would be the best purchases of, for that 3%. And I see some of the one-time purchases around assistive technology as a pretty functional way to use some of that, as well as I'm the one that put in behavioral supports, because I don't think we can ever have enough behavioral supports.
Modifications, the dwelling modifications, a lot of that can be done through CDG and home programs they do here anyway.
Exactly. And so that's why, as we each are doing our proposals that we're putting forward, and we have someone at central office that we're working with, we have to, one of the things we have to do is identify where else these services can be feasible. And so that's kind of where we're at. When we come up with a more complete package of what we're going to suggest and roll forward, I will bring that to you. But right now, we're still just working on trying to come together as a group to figure out what our recommendations will be. We have to have this done by the end of October.
Yeah. And it's a Medicaid state plan service, so yes. This is bigger than developmental disabilities. And Medicaid personal care currently is bigger than developmental disabilities.
Right.
So this is a this would be like an entitlement. And the legislature last year figured out how that they could do this with no additional resource because of the 6% increase match. Now, what that will look like after the mental health lawsuits and the they knew the education one. That, they knew that was coming, and they've been planning for that. But the mental health one was a surprise.
Yeah.
So with assistive technology, that would include training for the individual as well. Because you said purchase of assistive technology. So I need to buy it, put it in my hands, but teach all the different
right. It's that
generalizing that skill.
Where we're running into is, as Mary said, this is way bigger than developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so, what our aging population advocates are bringing forth, or what the individuals for mental health are bringing forward, are different ideas than what developmental disabilities want to do with those 3%, which I think we should have it all. So.
I so move.
And if you want to be involved, just call them.
Thank you. Any new business?
One thing. Some of you signed up to be on the RFQ panel. So if you did, would you like raise your hand again?
Is that the one we talked about last spring?
Maybe.
I might have said that when I was looking at like 2.5 months of summer vacation.
Do you know who did? Do you know who did?
I survived my 7 days.
I wasn't here.
Okay, got to remind
me. I can't remember.
Okay, I will go try and find the note, listen to the tape. Well, I think it was on a work session.
I think we nominated Scott.
Yeah, and Ted.
That's what happened the last time I missed the meeting, but I'm here today.
I think it might have been Ted.
Should we talk to them a little bit more about what that entails?
Yes, actually.
Maybe. So the request for qualifications, we're going to be releasing sometime within the next month. And then we'll have another month for it to be open for the applications to come in. And then we'll be reviewing the applications. So we're probably looking at sometime early November to be reviewing applications, and we'll send those out to you in advance of a review meeting. And actually, it's going to be all online this year. We're using a new program called Zoom Grants, and from everything that we've heard from previous, another program in our department has used this program before, and it's very user-friendly for the staff who put out the request for qualifications. The people who apply and submit their proposals are saying that it's very user-friendly and they are loving it, as well as the people who have been on the review committee. So this really is an opportunity for you to be on the cutting edge of qualification reviews.
Nice pitch.
Yeah.
I will not for you as well.
Yeah, it's
late. See, caught a fish.
Okay, yeah, and we can schedule the time around schedules, and there may even really be an opportunity for you to just review it online at your leisure. So, okay, so Susan.
Well, I think.
Larry, okay, thank you.
That's a long ways off. I don't have to worry about it.
Anybody else? Yeah. We'll keep you posted.
Anywhere in the world, you can check it online.
There you go. All right.
Yeah. No more Arctic expeditions to DA.
Oh, I think I told you one time when you were down there in the Arctic.
Oh.
Someplace.
Yeah, Arctic.
And our RFQs are required by statute and by state contract every 4 years in contract, and so that's what we've been following. And part of it is to see if there are other qualified providers, which there may be some capacity issues right now. Part of it is because that's required by the state and actually Medicaid. So we don't promise anybody any money, which makes it a little different. And I don't think our current providers in good standing will be needing to fill out a lot of stuff because they're in good standing. There's no point in making them go through an exercise. But that's what it is. And we did one in babies recently. There was no one that responded to that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So we are down to two organizations for version 30. Yeah. 18 funding.
Thanks, Doug.
The one thing I was just struck today by and hadn't noticed is our public participation is really dwindling down. And if there's something that maybe we can brainstorm over the next few months to ramp up public participation so that, you know, we can truly hear what the public wants and respond accordingly.
I wonder if there's a correlation between audio taping the meetings and public participation.
I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I see.
That seems to me.
This is the first day of school also.
No, I understand.
But I agree. I think it's been less in this building than over in the public services building. Mm-hmm. And yet we can't really go to the public services building anymore because they lock that height at 5 now.
Right.
There's been another person living in the men's bathroom.
Well, you can be there, and they have security that will stay after hours. I'm trying to remember if the front doors are, because I've had some meetings in that building after front. There may be a way.
It's unfortunate because the parking is not, you don't have to pay here. Well, you do pay
right there. There's more parking here. Mm-hmm.
Right. Can you do a PR pitch at your October event?
We can.
Or we can send something out to family so that they know they're welcome.
And doesn't it show you to do that every month with the email?
Well, only if people ask to be on it. We don't know who we don't know. So if people ask to be on it, we email it out to whoever wants that.
Well, do we need to? We'll just invite the guy that lives in the bathroom, too.
One more.
There you go. Can we do door prizes or something?
Huh?
Do door prize drawing.
The county cannot be buying gifts for people.
Has there been any dates or topics set for the family training series this year yet?
I think they. They're working on the flyer, yes.
Okay.
The Jamie and Grace. You can call either one. I remember that Social Security is the 17th and 18th of February. And I don't remember the October and November ones.
got two days this year.
I don't know. Is that a Tuesday?
Well, the 14th was a Friday last year. It's not a leap year, so. 14th is on a Saturday. Yeah, Tuesday, Wednesday, sounds like 77. I say 4th of July, I meant that last day. It's my second day of school.
So Tuesday, Wednesday. So I think they'll be on Tuesdays. And then we added when social security is really people need to hear that more than once. Or twice.
Any other new business? Okay, motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
Our fighters make it so we have
to be for